From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services is drawing fire from some state lawmakers. The cause? The department has yet to follow a 2015 state law. It orders a new office focusing on program accountability. After years of delay, the state's latest mental hospital is nearly complete. State lawmakers recently heard a construction update. North Carolina State Auditor Beth Wood serves as a taxpayer watchdog. She says that role has helped her expose patterns of poor accounting practices across state agencies. You'll learn details. And we'll hear what North Carolina could learn from Alabama when it comes to protecting people from civil asset forfeiture abuse. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
$57.8 million. That is the amount to be paid into an escrow account by operators of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. Now, the payment was announced minutes after the Roy Cooper administration recently authorized permits for the building of the pipeline across eastern North Carolina. As presented by Governor Cooper's administration, he will control how the money is spent. Money, his administration is calling a voluntary contribution. And importantly, money that the North Carolina General Assembly wants to take control of. Carolina Journal has been reporting extensively on the many angles of this story. Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief. He joins us now. Rick, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, a voluntary contribution of nearly $58 million from four companies. I've not heard of that. Have you?
No, not until now. This is a new one. That's the way that the governor's budget office characterize this when the nonpartisan permanent staff members of the General Assembly, the top people in all those divisions, asked to explain this particular agreement, which was worked out between the developers and operators of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the governor's office.
But the money would not go into the state's general operating fund.
The agreement doesn't envision that at all, or at least that it wasn't said that it would do that. And that was one of the questions of the five questions that the General Assembly staff asked the budget office. You know, where's the money going to go? Who does it belong to? Who controls it? Is there any legal precedent for this sort of thing? Those are the questions the General Assembly's staff asked. And the answer that the budget office gave was this was a voluntary contribution, and then basically restated language in the memo that had already been released. So it was it's a new area of operation largely for the state.
Lots of questions, and you've brought them up in Carolina Journal's reporting about does the governor, any governor of North Carolina, have the legal authority or their constitutional authority to essentially negotiate money like this and take in money like this? And as you and I are talking, that seems to be an unanswered question.
The law seems to be silent about certain sorts of arrangements. Now, the law is very clear about things that are involved called settlements, fines, and payments. That money goes to the general to the Treasury and is supposed to go toward a public school fund unless it's arranged through some sort of settlement terms of agreements that are signed off on by all parties, including the General Assembly, such as the tobacco settlement, which then became money for the Golden Leaf Foundation. That's one example of it. Now, there's another example that's currently being litigated that also involves Roy Cooper indirectly, in that his predecessor, Mike Easley, worked out a deal with Smithfield Foods about cleaning up some of its environmental pollution, in which it would pay $25 million, I believe, to NC State to do some research, and then $2 million a year for a number of years to a fund that would be controlled by the Attorney General, whoever that was. The Civitas Institute sued, saying that that was unconstitutional, and that's still in court right now.
Now, this story has been developing pretty much every day for the past at least a week or two that Carolina Journal has been reporting on this. And, of course, it's gotten the attention, a lot of attention, of elected members of the North Carolina General Assembly because they want to control this money.
Right.
And so what has occurred in the debate at the General Assembly about this?
Well, the General Assembly was going into session to take care of a couple of other matters. One was providing funding, basically shifting funding so that a mandated class size reduction in the early grades of school, the school districts would have to actually spend that money on that, on hiring teachers for that, rather than using the money in a discretionary way, which they were able to do before. So they were going to address that. And secondly, they had been ordered by the courts to come up with a new way of dealing with the State Board of Elections and the Ethics Commission because they had tossed out – the Supreme Court had tossed out the most recent iteration of that. And so they were going to have to deal with those matters anyway, the election situation particularly, because candidate filing opens February 12th. And so they needed to get that resolved. And when they did those two things anyway, they also added this $57.8 million fund to the bill. And what they basically said was that this money is going to go – into the Treasury, and the money will be spent for improvements in public education in the eight counties through which the pipeline will run, basically the eight counties along the I-95 corridor in eastern North Carolina. These are all counties that are covered by the rather infamous Leandro decision, which talked about inadequate funding for schools in some of the poorest areas of the state. And so that would be a one-time amount of money, but they could use it for things like capital improvements and those sorts of things.
So essentially what was happening is that they were pushing back the legislative leaders in the North Carolina Senate, saying, no, Governor Cooper, we don't like this idea that we would not have any control over this $57.8 million. We want it to go here. And that led to a lot of fascinating debate among some of the senators.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, on February 8th, there was a very unusual joint meeting of the Appropriations Committees of the House and the Senate. Now, that basically comprises everybody. I mean, there's something like 100 plus members of the Appropriations Committee overall. And they met to discuss this particular measure. And what they were doing, what the Republican senators basically were doing, was an opportunity for them to query the governor's new legislative liaison, a gentleman named Lee Lilly, who just happened to have been hired 5 days earlier and who also happened to have been a lobbyist for Dominion Energy, which is one of the companies that owns a pipeline.
And this has generated a whole new angle to the story and a whole
right.
new set of questions.
Exactly. Whole issues of conflicts. What did he know? What didn't he know? He was not very responsive to questions, and the questions were very aggressive, and Democrats were furious. They said they were ambushing the guy. And to which, you know, my thought was, well, if you don't want to have a guy face tough questions, and don't hire somebody who worked for the company that's running the pipeline as your legislative liaison. But anyway, that was very testy and contentious. But it lasted a couple of hours, and then the following day, the Senate voted 37-8 to approve that measure after, again, more than 90 minutes of debate, which is very unusual for a conference report, because in a conference report, it's an up or down vote. You can't change any aspect of it. And so typically, there are only a few comments made. But in this case, there was a lengthy debate with Republicans raising the question of, as Senator Dan Bishop of Mecklenburg County said, we're tiptoeing toward a constitutional conflict. If the governor can go out and raise money from outside parties and not subject it to legislative oversight and control all the money. And the Democrats seemed to be more concerned about the fact that the bill was messy. And so they sort of tried to dodge
that it had those three big issues all rolled into one.
Yeah, they didn't really want to talk about what the pipeline money was for and why it might be troubling to give the governor powers that don't seem to be laid out in the Constitution.
Once the final outcome of this whole question, who controls this $57.8 million, is determined, Rick, is the losing side, whether it's the General Assembly or the governor, they willing to sue over this?
Possibly, because it's very easy to imagine that the governor would veto the measure and that there will be far significant margins to override that veto. If the governor goes to court, however, he's going to have to, during the discovery process, release all of the documents involved with this, and he's been very hesitant to give any information so far.
Well, it is a continually developing story, if that's a word, continually. And it's being reported on, of course, at CarolinaJournal.com. We've been talking with Rick Henderson, who is editor-in-chief. Rick, thanks so much for the update.
Thank you.
Stay with us. A lot more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Nearly 3 years have passed since North Carolina lawmakers ordered the State Health and Human Services Department to create a new unit. It was to be called the Office of Program Evaluation Reporting and Accountability, or OPRA. Legislative staffer Denise Thomas recently reminded lawmakers about OPRA's role.
You directed the secretary to appoint an OPRA director who has a minimum of 10 years' experience in program evaluation. You specified that the director shall perform the duties of the office independently and can only be removed from the position by the secretary effective 30 days after written notification. The notification had to include a justification for the removal, and it also had to, the notification had to come also to the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the President Pro Tem, the State Auditor, and the Director of Fiscal Research. The duties of the office included evaluating DHHS programs using evidence-based methodologies, developing an inventory of all of the DHHS programs, and publishing the inventory to a departmental website, developing an inventory of all DHHS contracts, responding promptly to information requests for program-level data and information. And the office was to have access to all data or records maintained by the department. They were authorized to interview department employees and to conduct announced or unannounced inspections of DHHS facilities.
The department's chief financial officer, Rod Davis, offered lawmakers an update.
The recruitment for the director of the office has been conducted by the leadership team and by our HR department. To date, we have been unable to hire anyone. There have been no expenditure of funds from those appropriations, and that office has not been able to do any evaluations under the auspices of that office.
Davis says the Health and Human Services Department has been working on an alternative way to meet lawmakers' demands.
The Division of Budget and Analysis is an independent agency in the department. They're currently positioned to objectively assess and evaluate programs in areas of performance across all of our divisions. Just as with the Office of Internal Audits, they operate independently. They provide department-wide reviews and analysis of all our programs and functions. And budget analysis is positioned to identify and understand how our programs interrelate and how they align with the services performed for citizens.
Lawmakers are not thrilled about the 3 years of inaction involving the OPRA office. Republican Senator Ralph Hise of Mitchell County shared his concerns.
Do you understand how frustrating this is for the members of the General Assembly? 3 years now, we have required the creation of an office. We felt there was a significant deficiency in how programs were evaluated for outcomes. And this is across two administrations. This isn't, I wouldn't say it's targeted or specific there, but actually three administrations, if we come there, that we feel that programs quite frankly, are not evaluated for their outcomes and for how they're impacting population. There, how many did we serve or others, but what we're saving, how we're improving health and others. We spent a lot of time developing this with our own program evaluation division that's here. We again put the positions in. We funded them for 3 years, and once again we get another report that, that for all practical purposes, the department has done nothing. It looks to me as if there's just certain evaluations the department doesn't want done of their programs. They're afraid that that would be a layout of their expenditures would have transparency and insight into them that go beyond their authority. So I'm just going to start with, do you understand how frustrating that is for a third year?
Yes, sir, I do understand. And this is an area that we would like to do much better and intend to do much better. The issue we've had is we went into this thinking we should hire the director first and let them hire their staff. We haven't been able to fill the director position. The candidates that I've talked to afterwards have said that the way the position is set up and the way it reports and is confusing to them, and they were basically just uncertain about what would happen with it.
Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen added to the conversation.
While we have tried to move forward on hiring the person to run this, what we haven't waited on is doing the work. And so Rod outlined for you a lot of the places in which I think we are beefing up our capacity to do evaluations, but I think we need to do more. And what I'd love to do is sit down and think about how do we use the funding that was appropriated for this to beef up the systems that we currently have as opposed to build something new. And I think that that is where I would like to see our focus going forward.
These answers didn't satisfy lawmakers such as State Representative Josh Dobson.
If we're not getting the quality or if there's things that need to be changed in OPERA that would allow you to more effectively hire the appropriate person, I would love to work with you on that. The statute is not a suggestion. It is in statute. And the way our system works, you're required to follow the statutes in place. So it's incredibly frustrating. I don't know that OPERA is the best approach to get to where we want to go, but it's in statute, and that's not a suggestion. That's what the law is. So I hope that we can work together to see this to fruition going forward.
Republican Senator Tommy Tucker of Union County used the debate about the OPERA office to make a more general observation about the State Department of Health and Human Services.
We have seen numerous times where the Department of HHS over three administrations has totally and completely ignored the statutes. Just didn't do it. Not do it. No response. Now, I will grant you the information that staff is getting over the years is better than it used to be. Oh, my goodness. Y'all have done a better job. But like Representative Dobson says, this is here for a reason. And, you know, if it's not the best way, you know, we need to do something different. But the reporting directly to the secretary with nobody else to report to gives this individual and this department the independence it needs. And I'm concerned that there's a reluctance to want to be transparent with what we have to do. So I would either say come back to us or get about it. Accountability is very difficult in our society today. Nobody wants to be accountable, and numbers and data hold you accountable in my business and in the department.
Republican Representative Nelson Dollar wants to see some sign that state officials are addressing the OPERA office's goals.
There was a comment that the work was ongoing, that although the office had not been set up, the work was ongoing. So I guess my question is, and I apologize for this being pointed, but so is there a particular work product along this line that can be shared that is directly in line with the with what was being requested in the budget these last several years?
The short answer is yes. I mean, there's a long list of different types of activities that folks were hoping we would do, and a number of them today we can give you work product.
That's State Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen. She's addressing state lawmakers' frustrations. Cohen's department has yet to set up an independent accountability office nearly 3 years after it was ordered in state law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. After years of delays, North Carolina's newest state mental hospital is nearly complete. Mark Benton of the State Department of Health and Human Services recently updated lawmakers on Broughton Hospital in Morganton.
The original contract was awarded and the contractor was given permission to proceed with their work back in April of 2012. It was hoped at that time that the hospital, all of the construction would be completed a little more than 2 years later in September of 2014. Those dates have changed, and the last dates we're now looking at is between March and May of this calendar year.
What went wrong?
There was a lack of adequate project management. There was certainly a lack of quality control and sufficient manpower, at least up until recently, and a lack of site management and protection of the soils around the hospital campus. Some of the evidence of particularly the lack of project management or adequate project management and quality control sort of left us with dealing with and the contractor dealing with having to correct 60% of the floors for a description in the elevation of those floors, having to remove and replace nearly 40% of all the fireproofing in the facility, having to rework for the misalignment of a pedestrian bridge that links to the east staff entrance of the building, Also, rework that needed to be done to remove and replace improper floor toppings, and that's sort of the terrazzo flooring that goes on top. And then also having to rework and correct the anchoring of a major curtain wall in one of the wings of the hospital. And finally, there was also additional work that needed to be done to remove and replace framing and soil around the hospital proper.
Two state mental hospitals have been replaced now in recent years. Republican Representative Josh Dobson asked State Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen about the impact.
The addition of the 85 beds at Broughton and the 97 at Cherry, how much does this move the needle? How much further does this? And I know this is a broad question, but how far does this move the needle to get us to where we need to go?
This helps. But what is really important about our state hospitals in general is not just the number of beds that we have, which is important, and we need to staff up to open all of those beds, but it's also our ability to move patients through the hospital, and meaning when they're ready for discharge, to be able to discharge them back to the community. Because right now, if you look at any one of our hospitals, almost a third of our patients are waiting for discharge back to the community, and the issue is that there's nowhere for us to discharge them to. There's not community services that are ready and able to catch them. But we have a lot of work ongoing to think about how do we do that better.
You've been listening to an update on North Carolina's state mental hospitals. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation. We're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. You could consider our next guest to be the taxpayer's watchdog. That's the title she used for a recent presentation to the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society. Our guest is Beth Wood, North Carolina's state auditor. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, a lot of people are familiar with the concept of an auditor. They might have one for their business. How is the state auditor and the state auditor's office different from just a standard business auditor?
Well, for most part, the state auditor's office is working for the people. We spend $43 billion a year in your tax dollars to run state government. And the state auditor's office is responsible for making sure those dollars are reported right, the transactions are recorded properly, but I think more importantly that your tax dollars are not wasted. So not only are we doing a financial statement audit like many businesses are accustomed to having, we're also doing performance audits to look at duplicative efforts for looking at, is your tax dollars being wasted? We are doing information technology audits, and we have an investigative unit. So if someone suspects that federal dollars that pass through the state of North Carolina or state dollars are being misappropriated, we'll go out and take a look at that. We're looking for illegal activity at that point.
And those are some of the activities that you're involved in that would make you a taxpayer's watchdog.
Absolutely, because it's your tax dollars that we're looking at, number one, to make sure they're not wasted or abused. And I tell people all the time, that's not against the law, but it probably should be. And then from an illegal perspective, we're looking at those issues also as reported to our office.
As you go about this and your auditors are doing their work, what are some of the main things that you're finding that are important for the public to know?
Oh, absolutely. First and foremost, two things, two issues, and I've talked to the General Assembly about this on a couple of occasions, but one of the biggest issues that we're finding is contracting practices in the state of North Carolina. We simply, as an agency, as a state government, we are entering into contracts written by the vendor. We don't necessarily have the talent for going through there and making sure we've got a contract written in the best interest of the state of North Carolina. And time after time after time and hundreds of millions of dollars, the state of North Carolina has been taken to the cleaners by vendors because of poorly written contracts. And when I say poorly written, I'm talking about something as fundamental as a contract not having a non-performance clause in it or no non-performance penalties. We have tried to fire vendors. They sued us, and they won because of the poorly written contracts that we had in place. And then the other piece I would tell you is lack of accountability. People think all the time my tax dollars in Raleigh being, corruptively spent. But again, I tell people all the time there is the biggest risk for your tax dollars is there is a lack of accountability in our state government for how they're being spent.
We are chatting with North Carolina's state auditor, Beth Wood. Let's return to both of those topics. First of all, you mentioned these poorly written contracts. What has been done, or is there anything in the works to help address this?
There has been. We've taken these findings to the General Assembly three times in my over the course of my administration, and they have tried to fix the law that would make somebody look at these contracts and make sure they're written in the best interest of the state of North Carolina before we ever put our name on the bottom line. It's still not fixed. We have in play right now certain laws that say if a contract is going to be for $5 million or more, DOA, Department of Administration, has to take a look at it and review it. If it's going to be for $10 million or more, then the contract before it's entered into will be looked at by the Attorney General's office. But I just explained to the General Assembly in 2016 that if I, as an agency head, enters into a contract, and it's the worst contract written in the history of North Carolina, if I do that as an agency head, and I don't run it by the Attorney General's office, and I don't run it by the Department of Administration, that contract is binding. And there's nothing anybody can do to me for not going through the process that's carved in stone in our statute. So there's still a hole big enough to drive a truck through with our contracting practices.
So something the General Assembly could still address on this front.
And they are trying. They absolutely are. Within a week of me making that presentation to them, they were looking at ways to fix that law and make it better.
How about on the accountability front? You mentioned that as another big piece. Are there things being done to build in more accountability?
Not as we speak. I've had a conversation with the director of budget in this administration, and we all know that we need accountability for here's the budget that you get each year in your agency. Here are the things that your agency should be accomplishing. Here's how much it should cost to accomplish those things. And how well or not did you do? And so there is a lot of conversation around that, but I would say the State Auditor's Office is the only agency thus far that I'm aware of that's actually put metrics into practice with what you are getting in a budget, how you're supposed to be spending that money, and how you measure against that.
As you just described it, that sounds like something that any operation, including a business or a government agency, should want. We're spending this money. Let's make sure we're getting what we're spending it on.
You're absolutely right. And there's no business that I can think of that can stay in business, particularly now in these tough economic times where every dollar counts, every man hour counts. So I don't understand that this concept is not being taken up more statewide in our state government.
Now, we've focused on some sort of structural issues. How much of a problem do we have with something you alluded to earlier of actually people trying to do something nefarious or behind the scenes? Do we have that happen very often in government that you find?
We have a lot of calls on my hotline, probably about 800 a year. But when we get down into it and we look at issues that really need to be looked into, and then we get down to how many things we substantiate, usually about 20 to 30 reports a year. So you're going from 800 phone calls down to 30 that are really substantiated. And then the dollars are not tremendously big. Of course, I've always heard since I've worked with state government that it's not the big pots of money where the theft occurs. It really is a smaller pot of money where nobody is really looking. And we have an example of that in Wake County. You look at the Register of Deeds. When I've gone back and looked at the work that the auditors, their external auditors, did, the cash that runs through the Register of Deeds office is insignificant to the amount of cash that runs through the Wake County totally, so the auditors never looked at the cash there. So again, it's those smaller pots of money. So again, it's still not a huge impact, but in this day and time, every dollar counts. So none of it needs to be stolen away.
Well, we know that one person who is interested in making sure that every one of those dollars is spent in the way that it was appropriated to be spent is Beth Wood. She is the elected North Carolina State Auditor, speaking recently to the John Locke Foundation Shaftesbury Society under the theme, The Taxpayer's Watchdog. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Full color throughout every issue, more visual storytelling. We've revamped Carolina Journal to make it easier to read, a new look and a new feel. But one thing hasn't changed, and it never will. That is our commitment to truth and transparency in government. You can still count on Carolina Journal for investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, and vetting of corruption. No, our mission to shine the light on what North Carolina government and the bureaucrats who run it are doing in your name and with your money will never wane. And because of that, our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our distribution outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians every month. So make sure you stay informed. Read the monthly print edition of Carolina Journal. Then check in several times a day at carolinajournal.com. That's where you'll find fresh stories, opinion pieces, and updates on government, politics, and your money. Carolina Journal, we hold government accountable to you. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, it's called civil asset forfeiture, an abusive process that empowers law enforcement agencies to confiscate property from people who've never been charged with, let alone convicted, of a crime. Our next guest says that North Carolina has been a leader in protecting North Carolinians from this abuse, but that the state of Alabama is poised to do something that could put that state ahead of our own. John Guzet is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Legal Studies. He joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Donna.
Explain how this whole thing works in North Carolina. What is it that law enforcement agencies can and can't do?
Well, unlike most states, North Carolina has never really gotten on the civil asset forfeiture bandwagon, and for good reason. Just as you say, it's just an abusive due process. It abuses people's property rights. Fortunately, in North Carolina, almost always, in order to take somebody's property, even if you suspect it was used or derived from criminal activity, you have to prove that that person, not only do you have to prove that person committed a crime, but you have to prove that the property was actually derived from that crime. That's criminal forfeiture, and it's a different thing, and it's much more fair and reasonable, and that's most of the time the way you have to do it in North Carolina.
And when you say property, what kinds of things are we talking about?
It could be cash. It could be vehicles. It could even be a house or other forms of real estate.
So North Carolina has been trying to protect its citizens from this type of thing. So you have to be convicted of criminal activity in order for that to go forward. Do other states handle this the same way?
Well, until recently, almost every other state in the union didn't handle it this way. In fact, they allowed their police forces to take property through this process called civil asset forfeiture. The advantages from the police department's point of view is through civil forfeiture, they don't have to prove that there was a crime. They don't even have to charge anybody with a crime. It's a civil It's a civil action that's against the property itself. That means, firstly, that you don't have to convict the owner. And furthermore, you don't have to use the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what applies in criminal cases. Because it's a civil proceeding, you only have to show that it's more likely than not that the property was used for a crime.
John, you've been writing about this for a number of weeks now, and you've been watching what's been happening in other states. And as you and I are talking, the state of Alabama has a champion for essentially getting rid of this whole type of thing.
That's right. Alabama has been one of the worst states until recently. But right now there's a bill before the legislature that would, as I say in my update, it would actually put Alabama probably at the top of the list. The Institute for Justice ranks all the states every few years in terms of how well or badly they're doing when it comes to asset forfeiture. North Carolina has always been at the top of the list. But I think if Alabama passes this bill, they're going to supersede us and go right to the head of the class.
Why is that?
For a couple of reasons. One reason is that unlike North Carolina, where there are a few exceptions, there are some circumstances, for instance, driving while under the influence, under certain circumstances, you can lose your vehicle through civil asset forfeiture. So there are some exceptions in North Carolina, but the Alabama legislation would eliminate all exceptions. There would simply be no more civil asset forfeiture under Alabama law. That's interesting, but I don't think that's the main reason why it's going to send them to the top of the class, and it's not the main reason why we ought to be interested in this legislation. What Alabama also does is it prevents what we call anti-circumvention. In many states, including in North Carolina, local law enforcement agencies and state law enforcement agencies can use federal law to circumvent state protections against civil asset forfeiture. They do that by either something called an adoptions program, which it's simply a pure circumvention policy that allows them to take property, process it through the federal courts under federal law, and then get back 80% of the assets for their own use.
John, before you go ahead and talk about the other way that that's done, I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying here. So North Carolina has been trying to protect its citizens from this. But you're saying that in North Carolina and in other states, in some states, that law enforcement can still get around the state law, essentially, by going to a federal law?
That's exactly right. So, for instance, in North Carolina, if a state trooper pulls over a motorist, finds cash, and suspects it was drug proceeds, if they go under North Carolina law, they still have to charge that person with some kind of drug-related offense. They have to have them convicted under North Carolina law. And they have to show that it actually was proceeds, that cash wasn't something that they got in a legitimate way. And I want to go back and mention another protection we have under North Carolina law. If they do this under North Carolina law, that cash that they took, even if they get it forfeited through the state criminal forfeiture statutes, under our Constitution, that cash has to be used for public education. The police agency that took the money doesn't get to keep it and use it. If they go through the federal adoptions program, however, they take it to a federal judge or magistrate, and they get under federal drug control laws, when that money eventually comes back to them after being processed by the feds, 80% of it comes back, they get to keep it.
So if I'm the law enforcement agency, this is a revenue stream for me.
Absolutely.
I mean, this would be something that I can understand the rationale for them to pursue this, to go around North Carolina law and use the federal law.
Of course. And it's a perverse incentive because even though most police officers and state troopers are honest, and most departments want to use that money for the good of the public, it's not the constitutional way. They should get their revenue by having it allocated by the General Assembly, not by taking it directly from the citizens.
You said that there is a second way that law enforcement can actually use this federal law. The first one you just described was what's called adoptions, that process where 80% comes back to them. There's something called joint task forces. How does that work?
Well, that's the other way that federal asset forfeiture can result in money from forfeitures getting into the hands of police departments in North Carolina. If they participate in some kind of joint task force or joint operation with federal law enforcement agencies, then there's an equitable sharing process by which a portion of the proceeds from any forfeited assets come back to whichever department or to all the departments that were involved in the seizure. Now, unlike adoptions, there's some legitimacy to this. I mean, we do want our law enforcement agencies to participate with federal law enforcement when it makes sense, but we don't want them to be tempted to do this simply in the hope of gaining the revenue.
John, how does North Carolina compare with other states? We've mentioned several times that we are a leader in trying to protect North Carolinians. What do other states do?
Well, this is where this is the one area where we're not a leader, because we don't do anything to prevent that kind of circumvention under North Carolina law. And as
you're
a result,
talking about going to the feds and using
right,
that law.
Through equitable sharing, either through adoptions or under joint or as part of joint task force operations. So that's the one area where we actually are at the back of the pack with other states. And this is where Alabama is going to rise to the top and really give us a lesson that we can learn, because one of the great things that that Alabama statute would do if it passes is it would eliminate what we talked about in the first place, which is the adoption program altogether. In Alabama, state and local law enforcement wouldn't be allowed to engage in, wouldn't be allowed to use the adoptions program at all. And it would also put some limits on what they could do with joint task force. So they can certainly participate in joint task force, but they can't share in the revenues unless the total amount seized is over $100,000. And that's a good number, because it means that most of the time they aren't going to get any money. And in a big seizure like that, chances are it's going to be legitimate and people are going to think twice before they just casually take somebody's property.
You actually detailed agencies in North Carolina, that law enforcement agencies that are participating in this asset sharing. What kind of money are we talking about here, John? Is it $1 million? Is it $50 million?
Millions of dollars. And if you look at the table that we provide there, we just listed the 50 agencies that get the most, and many of them are getting millions of dollars just on their own.
John Guzet, who is Director of Legal Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Thank you, John. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.